Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is Friday, October the 26th, and we are going to do our best to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus. We're going to take the headline news, we're going to apply the mind of Christ, and then we are going to go forth as the ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven into the midst of the kingdoms of this world, and really genuinely seek to bring God back into every conversation. So let's get started. There's so many places that we could begin today. Let me start with this, because I think that even just in that really awful, terrifying headline that we just heard about two girls in Central Florida planning to kill their classmates, drink their blood in order that they could go to hell and be with Satan. And we're talking here about very young people, 10 and 11 years old. I mean, we're talking about little girls. And so I think that when we have headlines like that in our culture, we have to, you know, we got to take a deep breath and we got to pause and we got to say, what is going on here? And so I think that it's a good opportunity today to talk about the range of spiritual interests that Americans are currently expressing. And so there's a number of headlines that we could turn to. And so I'm going to turn to like three of them in fairly quick succession just to highlight what it feels like is going on. And I may or may not be, you know, statistics may not perfectly prove me out here. But we know that we have a growing percentage of the population who self-identify as people of no particular belief. So we describe them as nuns, something like 24% of the population. Now, that's a lot of people who are saying, well, I don't easily fall into any of those categories, any of those boxes that you have drawn there. So I'm not, you know, I don't identify as a Christian. I don't identify as Jewish. I don't identify as Muslim, or I don't identify as Hindu, or any string of options that might be listed there. And so what they are identifying as is none, N-O-N-E. And we have a rising percentage of the culture who identify as nuns. Now, does that mean that they are people of no spiritual belief? Not exactly. Does it mean that they are ardent atheists, that they are actually believe that God does not exist? Well, not necessarily, because there's actually a rising trend, a rising tide in those who believe in spiritual things, spiritual ideas that are impersonal. And here I would introduce specifically astrology. Now, you're going to say astrology. Let me stop there for a moment, because that sounds a lot like astronomy. And astronomy is an actual science, right? Astronomy is the actual like scientific study of the movement, the organization of the planets and the stars and constellations and other stuff flying about out there in the astronomical universe. So we're not talking about astronomy. We're talking about astrology. And so here we're talking about horoscopes. We're talking about signs, like, you know, what sign were you born under? And so let me talk about atheists and atheism in America. And then let me talk about astrology and its rising, the rising interest in astrology among millennials. And then I'm going to talk about very briefly Sinead O'Connor, who you might recognize her name. She's an artist, musician, and she has announced that she's converted to Islam and changed her name to Shahada David. And she then very quickly points out this is the natural conclusion of any intelligent theologian's journey, basically saying if you don't believe what she believes, well, you're just not as smart as she is. So it's a good conversation starters today in terms of belief and non-belief and our ability to engage others in conversation about what they're thinking and feeling and why they believe it. All right. So let me start with why Americans are still uncomfortable with atheism. And this is actually a piece that's going to appear in the print edition of The New Yorker under a title. It's going to have a different title. Let me see if I know what the print edition is going to call it. because the online edition of The New Yorker entitles it, Why Are Americans Still Uncomfortable with Atheism? But in the print edition, when it comes out on the 29th of October, this article is going to be called Without a Prayer, which is interesting because that insinuates that people actually do understand that in order to pray, there must be a being to whom we are praying. And so prayer itself is an act of, is a theistic act. It's not necessarily a Christian act, but it is a theistic act. And so if you can, you know, get to the place in a conversation where you're talking with somebody about their prayers and whether or not they pray and what they pray for, then you get, you can get to whom do they pray and how do they think that those prayers are heard? Because that leads you into a very natural conversation about Jesus being the one who, you know, tears from top to bottom the curtain that separates, you know, humanity from the Holy of Holies in order that we might just enter straight in and talk to God ourselves with no further intermediary, and that those prayers are translated by the power of the Holy Spirit, bringing everything into conformity with God's will, because obviously nothing unholy can enter even into his presence. So we as a nation have a very theistic history. We have a very theistic beginning. Now, I'm not saying that in every case the founders were Christians. What I am saying is they were all at least deist. They did believe in the reality of a higher power, a supreme being. And so part of the conversation that's raised in this New Yorker piece is, and I think it's really a piece about religious liberty. That might be the way that I would characterize this particular article. It leads off with this: true religious liberty was rare in the colonies. Dissenters were fined, flogged, jailed, and sometimes hanged. But surprisingly, no atheist was ever executed. So here was the deal. You had to actually toe the theological line of the particular colony of which you were a part. But if you didn't believe, and you sort of kept that non-belief to yourself, yeah, nah, nobody was coming after you. Nobody was looking for that. Non-believers, it says, were either few and far between in colonial America or understandably cautious. I would say, yeah, you know, pretty quiet. If you didn't believe and you were in a culture that overwhelmingly did believe and had blasphemy laws and all kinds of other things, then in all likelihood, you're pretty much going to live and let live. And until a guy named Roger Williams, who, by the way, established the founded the colony of Rhode Island, he was looking for a different kind of religious liberty. He was looking for a religious liberty that would also leave room for people of no faith, leave room for atheists. And Roger Williams was actually banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony because he was spreading, quote, diverse, new, and dangerous opinions. And those diverse, new, and dangerous opinions were that, you know, here on this side of the Atlantic Ocean, we ought to accommodate people of no belief or non-belief, atheists, in addition to accommodating people of a variety of Christian beliefs. Those were sort of the two things he was concerned about. I mean, and he made this argument in 1644 that it didn't really matter if the captain of a ship from England to America was a Christian or not a Christian, that didn't really make any difference, that an anti or non-Christian pilot, captain, could be as skillful to carry the ship to its desired port as any Christian mariner might be. And so he was not just referring to ships. He was making a parallel there to the ship of state. And so it's an interesting conversation to have. It's striking that after the Revolutionary War, when our founders gathered at the Constitutional Convention, they actually banned religious tests for office holders. They said, you know, look, there's not going to be a government church. There's not going to be a state religion. And there's no mention of God in the founding text beyond the acknowledgement that it is signed in 1787, what? The year of the Lord. So religious freedom, as you and I both know, was formally established in the Constitution's First Amendment. But ideas about religious tolerance in the, you know, in the early years of these United States, those ideas were really only extended to people who still believed in some kind of higher power. It wasn't really extended to atheists. And why is that? Well, I would contend that it's because we are innately spiritual, and we know it. We recognize that we are spiritual beings. And so spiritual beings need to worship something, lest they worship themselves. And that's clearly a problem, the worship of self. But if you go ahead and exchange the truth about God for lies, then you will begin worshiping the creation instead of the creator. And so human beings will look around for something to worship. And democracy is inherently anti-deifying in terms of individuals, in terms of our leaders. We do not deify our leaders. We recognize that they are fallen, broken, sinful people. And you can read the headlines every day for evidence of that. But without God, if you are going to lift up people who don't believe in God and a higher power and an ultimate judge, then you are elevating into leadership people who believe they are the highest power and they are the judge. They are not only those who are in place to enforce the law, they are kind of the lawgiver. And that's a dangerous kind of person. That's a dangerous personality. And so there's a connection between the American appreciation for and commitment to democracy, even in the representative republic variety that we have, versus thinking that a king, a sovereign, could be human. And so, part of the reason that Americans, sort of resist atheism and atheists is because we don't want people thinking that they're God or God-like or God-ish or God-esque. And so I also think that it's important, sort of to note and recognize that during the Cold War years, which now we're talking about the mid-20th century, in a rejection of communism, there is also a rejection of atheism. And so part of the rise in conversation related to religious liberty and the defense of religious ideas here in the United States of America really does rise up in the Cold War years. And so it was in the mid-1950s that the prayer breakfast appeared on the White House calendar. A prayer room opened in the Capitol building, and God We Trust was added to all of our currency, and Under God was inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance. And so I think that it's important to note that those are not things that happened at the foundation of the nation, but when Christian ideas specifically, but theistic ideas in general, were threatened by communism and the rise of the USSR. And so I just think that it's an interesting conversation to engage in. It's interesting to think about why atheists believe what they believe, don't believe what they don't believe, and what it means for us in our culture today to be in very open conversations about a growing percentage of our population who not only do not believe in any specific religious expression, but they don't believe in God at all. And so you and I, who want to be conversational apologetics and bring God back into every conversation, we face a unique challenge in terms of how we're going to do that with people who wouldn't even acknowledge that there is a God. So there you go. That's the start of a conversation. Hey, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about why millennials are ditching religion for witchcraft and astrology. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, continuing with some headlines from today. So this article actually appears in a couple of different forms. I pulled this particular version off of MarketWatch, which is a way of understanding sort of what's going on in the culture and its effect on the economy, which is an interesting place to find an article entitled Why Millennials Are Ditching Religion for Witchcraft and Astrology. And so it starts out as an article about these tumultuous political times, and then it's looking specifically at the 18 to 30-year-old demographic in the country and what they believe and to whom they are looking for inspiration and instruction. And I think that any time that we think about how it is that we are going to influence others and how we as Christians are going to help people, acknowledge God, come into a relationship with God, knowing where they're starting from is really, really important. And so let me just read the opening few sentences of this particular piece. It says, when Coco Lane, a Brooklyn-based producer, meets someone new these days, the final question that comes up in conversation, or not the final question, the first question, excuse me. The first question is this: what's your sign? Now, I'm gonna stop right there just for a moment. For those of you who know who Jeff Foxworthy is and you're old enough to remember the, here's your sign, sketch that he does, you might have a very quick mental, answer to a person posing a question, what's your sign? Obviously, when Coco Lane, is asking that of people wandering around in Brooklyn, with whom, Coco is engaging in conversation, and I don't know if Coco is male or female, so that's why I'm simply saying the person's name. It's not a conversation about where do you live or what do you do or, God forbid, where do you go to church. The question is, what's your sign? Now, let me tell you, in Nashville, Tennessee, one of the first questions that comes up in conversation is, where do you go to church? Because culturally, that's what's going on. Culturally, in Brooklyn, what's going on is astrology and horoscopes. So here's the next paragraph. Many millennials read their horoscopes every day, and they believe them. They live by them. It creates for them a good reference point to identify and place people in the world. Now, let's pause right there, because we have talked on several occasions here on Connecting Faith about the really big questions that people are looking for answers to. One of those is the question of identity. One of those is the question of belonging, and the third is about your purpose. So identity, belonging, and purpose, those are really the three primary questions that people are asking and seeking answers to. And what Coco Lane is saying is that increasingly millennials in this 18 to 30-year-old age band, they are increasingly finding the answers to those questions in a horoscope. Now, who exactly is writing horoscopes? This is a question you should ask yourself. And horoscopes can be generated by AI now. We can actually have them just computer generated, aggregating all kinds of weird information and producing the equivalent of what it comes in a fortune cookie. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And people are actually putting not just their faith, but they are constructing a system of belief about who they are and where they fit in the world. That's what this person who is regarded as an expert on these issues is saying. So we have an increasing percentage of millennials who say they doubt the existence of God, while more than half of young adults believe that astrology is a science. Now just think about that for just a moment. They actually think that it's a science. Now, the Chinese, from whom these ideas actually emerge, only 8% of the Chinese public think that it's a science. Like, they know it's a religion. They know that it is a belief system. They know that that these are not things that are based in science. And yet, we are seeing not only a rise in the occult, we are seeing a rise in all kinds of witchcraft, and we've talked about that here recently on Connecting Faith as well. Here is the walk-off of this paragraph. There is a belief vacuum, and so we go from, he's talking here as a millennial, we go from work to the bar to dinner with friends, maybe then to a date or a hookup. We have no semblance of meaning in any of it. So astrology is a way of putting yourself in the context of thousands of years of history and in the universe. Now, what they're talking about there is that this is the way people are finding themselves. They're locating themselves in the scope of human existence and in the scope of human experience over the course of time. Well, that is precisely what God wants to help us understand about ourselves as integrally connected to and important in his unfolding redemptive plan that spans all of history. Reading the Bible actually helps us do this. It helps us find our place in God's story. It helps us know who God is and what God's up to and how we fit in to all of that. And so let me encourage you to be reaching out to people in this age band, 18 to 30, and just asking them, hey, have you noticed that, you know, in your peer group, people have an interest, you know, seemingly greater interest in astrology? Can you tell me about that? Like, where are you seeing that? Where are you experiencing that? Are you into that? Get the conversation started, not in a way that's in any way judgmental, but as a way of talking about something that ultimately leads to a conversation about identity, belonging, and purpose. Because I trust me when I tell you, that's what they're searching for. And it's going to start with a conversation with somebody who knows who they are, in terms of being an image bearer of God, a person redeemed in Jesus Christ, who can invite somebody into the kind of relationship where we find real belonging and hope. And in all of that, we find our purpose, which is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Okay, I told you I was going to get to this Sinead O'Connor converting to Islam story. And so I want to quickly do that. Irish singer Sinead O'Connor has announced that she has converted to Islam. And she has changed her name from Sinead to Shahada. And she said this about her decision. This is the natural conclusion of any intelligent theologian's journey. She actually said more than that on Twitter that pretty much castigated anybody that doesn't believe the way she now believes in terms of her commitment to Islam. She's now advocating that women wear a hijab. She says, wear a hijab, just do it. And she added there the Nike swoosh. And this is apparently a part of her new Twitter online presence and her advocacy. And it looks like it's paid for by Nike. She has a Islamic cleric who is sharing on social media as well, videos of her and all kinds of other things. It's curious to me because Sinead O'Connor is one of the people who has very publicly come out in the past and been openly critical of her own Irish Catholic upbringing. She's been very critical of organized religion. And now we have her, you know, saying that by a long intellectual pursuit, she's actually joining, converted to and joining a religious body that is openly hostile to women around the world, subjugating in terms of its leadership. I mean, anyway, just on and on. So we're going to have to talk more about that. I gotta pause right now, though, because next up we're going to have Robert Wolgemuth here on Connecting Faith, and he and I are going to talk about lies men believe and the truth that sets them free. So hang out. We'll be right back. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I am your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined now by my friend and colleague in ministry, Robert Wolgemuth.
I'm going to let you talk here about the book. Lying has obviously been around since the first man and the first woman. Why don't you talk about the difference between lies and truth and identify some of the lies in the book?
Oh, good. Well, thank you. I'm happy to do that. It's my privilege, actually, to write this book. It's just been out for a couple of weeks and doing very well. It's a follow-up to a book that my wife Nancy wrote in 2001 called Lies Women Believe. And that book is actually north of a million copies and continues to sell very well around the world, actually, in many translations. So when we were engaged, we had a conversation about a follow-up book for Lies Women Believe called Lies Men Believe. Nancy told me, but over the years, various authors, men, had come to her and said, I think I'm the guy to write that book. And she said she just never felt clarity to go ahead and do that. But now we're engaged, and so she pops the question. And I said I would be honored to do that. So last summer, we sat on the deck behind our home in Michigan, and I wrote Lies Men Believe, and she wrote the updated and revised edition of Lies Women Believe. So we spent several months sitting side by side writing lies, which, of course, we've had a lot of fun telling our friends about. But lies are serious, as you said in your opening introduction. And, you know, in fact, lies come in many shapes and sizes. You know, a lie can be an answer to a policeman pulling you over saying, do you know how fast you were going? Or are you involved in an affair? And men understand the temptation for both of those questions to not tell the truth. So we unpacked 40 lies, and I had a committee of good friends. We went through all kinds of possibilities, probably 100 different lies, and narrowed it down to 40. And they're organized by section. Lies men believe about themselves, about God. In fact, lies they believe about God is the first section. But lies men believe about sin, sexuality, themselves, work and wealth, family, relationships, and so forth. And it's been a wonderful journey to be able to do this. And part of it is, and you're an author, you understand this, it's a conversation. This is not a book. It's a conversation. There's no microphone involved, no podium, no platform. It's just the reader and me opening our hearts to each other. And I have an opportunity to go through these lies one at a time. And the truth that sets them free. The largest word on the cover is the word lies. But the most important word on the cover is truth. So, yes, this is about 40 lies, but it's also including 40 corresponding truths from God's word. That's the stuff that we hang on to. That's the stuff that makes the difference. So grateful to have a chance to come alongside Nancy in this way. And the early response, as I said, has been really amazing. I'm very, very grateful for it.
So again, friends, my conversation partner today is Robert Wolgemuth. You can find him online at robertwolgemuth.com. You can also find him on Twitter at @RobertWolgemuth. The book we're discussing is Lies Men Believe and the Truth That Sets Them Free. Robert, I'm wondering if we can actually just roam around in some of the lies, because I have four listed here out of the 40 that, I mean, you know, they're all really good and substantive, but in terms of, you know, the men I know and lies that they have believed at different points in time and things that are happening in the culture, maybe we could just look at, like, okay, here's a lie. I can hide my secret sin because it only hurts me.
Wow. Yeah, and you know, that's what's amazing about that is that you can live thinking that that's true, but first of all, starting with your own heart, even if people don't find out what it is that you're holding, the truth is it has a deep impact on you. And over the years, as a Sunday school teacher, as you know, Carmen, you've been my substitute teacher many times when I taught Sunday school in Orlando, Florida. But as I have interacted with men for 50 years, I've discovered that men who hide secrets, it impacts their lives in other ways, their health, of course, their relationships, their job performance, their attitudes toward other things in life. So, you know, the truth is, if that's the lie, the truth is my secret sins cannot be hidden indefinitely. They will one day be brought into light. I live in community, my marriage, my children, my neighborhood, my church, my workplace. What I do, good and not so good, impacts those around me. So what I've just done is read the corresponding truth to that lie. And again, the lie is important for men to read. It's even more important for them to read the truth that corresponds with that. And then I list several scriptural texts to underscore where all that comes from and how a man can set his mind on truthful things and escape the lies.
So, Robert, let's do the same thing with this lie. My faith and my work are unrelated.
Yeah, I think it was Luther. I've got to look this up because I've said this a couple of times. I think it was Luther who talked about the shoemaker who is distinguished as a Christian, not because he etches a cross in the sole of the shoe, but because he makes excellent shoes. My faith must speak to my work in the way that I interact with folks. Do I storm past the receptionist when I walk in the front door? How do I treat people? How do I write memorandums? How do I have meetings? How do I listen to people? How do I think about other people when I'm speaking to them? All those things show who I am as a follower of Christ. Now, I obviously am eager to tell people in the workplace that I follow Jesus. But I would never want that to be a surprise where they would say, you know, that's really interesting. The way I hear you talk, I had no idea that you were a religious man. That would be a nightmare, wouldn't it? So the consistency of my love for Christ and the way I work, the excellence with which I do things, the way I care for people in the workplace, there has to be a consistency there.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I appreciate how you frame that, because I do think that the integrated reality of Christ, my abiding in Christ, Christ therefore working his will out through me moment by moment, day by day, in all of the circumstances of life, that concept of an integrated life actually addresses or is revealed in many of these lies that you expose in this book, maybe most fully in the one where you talk about I can't help how I react to certain people or circumstances. Why don't you address that lie?
Well, that is a lie because I can through Christ. I mean, in truth, I can't without the power of Christ. In fact, it's interesting. Even over the last few weeks, I have been reminded that the most important lie and the corresponding truth is about holiness. Lie number 16 is holiness is boring. Holiness is boring. And I got that from my childhood. My grandparents used to take me to a camp, and it literally had the word holiness in it. It was in central Pennsylvania, and it was a holiness camp. And so as a little kid, I was exposed to this word holiness. And I thought this was anything but what I'd want for my own life. There's no excitement here. Well, wouldn't you know, I married a woman who wrote a book called Holiness. And she loves the concept of holiness. In fact, her dad came to faith in his 20s. And there's a quote in the book by Arthur DeMoss, that talks about the joy of living a holy life. So in many ways, that can be an umbrella over a lot of these things, that following Christ and being obedient, and as Jesus admonished us to living a holy life, is the most amazing, wonderful way that a man can live. And in fact, what he gets from that is not only healed relationships, but a good night's sleep. And who doesn't want that?
Well, absolutely. Hey, friends, my conversation partner is Robert Wolgemuth. The book is Lies Men Believe and the Truth That Sets Them Free. You can find Robert online at Robert Wolgemuth. That's on Twitter and also on Facebook. But you can find his website, robertwolgemuth.com. Hey, one final question, Robert. When we talk about the measuring of our lives, I think I actually think there's a tendency for both men and women to believe the lie of comparison. And so the way that you frame it in Lies Men Believe is this idea of men measuring their life in comparison to other men. Women do precisely the same thing, but I think that the answer to the question maybe is a little bit different. But address that particular lie.
Well, I married a woman who was 57 years old and never married. So she worked with a lot of male colleagues and has brothers who are men, of course, but didn't know really how a man thinks about a lot of things. And early in our relationship, I said to her, Nancy, I want you to know something about men, about we men. We compare and compete. And it may be on the racquetball court, but it also may be the car I drive, the house where I live, stuff that, you wouldn't necessarily think of as being in a, competitive setting. So I actually discovered a wonderful little secret to release myself from that tendency to compare and to compete. I talk about it in that chapter. I'd love to not tell you about it because it may sound really surface and really silly. I don't know if do we have enough time for me to tell a quick story about that?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So I travel a lot, and I often go to the West Coast. And if you've driven on California freeways, you know that almost every automobile on California freeway, Southern California, is a foreign import. It's immaculate, spotless, and amazing. And I'm always driving a rental car, and those are not necessarily up to the quality of the foreign imports that I'm driving close by. And I can't help but notice, okay, I'm a car guy. I've always been a car guy. So I pull up next to this guy in traffic, which happens a lot, and I look at his car, and he's sitting there, and he's pretty proud of it. You can just tell, right? You can look at his face, the set of his jaw. He's really proud of his ride. And so, I've done this so many times, and it just makes me smile thinking about it. I put the window down on the passenger side, which is right next to him. And I motioned for him to put his window down. And so he puts his window down, having no idea what I'm going to say, if I'm going to ask him directions or mock his car or whatever. And I say to him, "That's a phenomenal car. What a beautiful ride." And he's looking at me like, "What?" And then he smiles, and I feel this release. Again, I know this sounds really silly, and for maybe some of your listeners, a really surface thing to say, but I'm going to tell you, when I learn to celebrate and be grateful, that tendency to compare and compete absolutely leaves my spirit. It actually is a wonderful secret. And my hope in this book is to give men the opportunity to join in this conversation, this one-on-one with me, and come up with some really fun, doable things to help release him from these lies and to embrace the truth.
Oh, see, I just love that, and it's so practical, and it's so honest, and it deals with us where we really live. I really appreciate it. Hey, friends, the book is Lies Men Believe and the Truth That Sets Them Free. The author is Robert Wolgemuth. You can find it everywhere books are sold, and we are grateful. We are grateful for you, Robert. We're grateful for Nancy. We're grateful for the fellowship that we have with the two of you here on Faith Radio. And we look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen. My pleasure. Blessings to you.
Blessings. Hey, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I always appreciate the opportunity to gather with you here on Connecting Faith. So in today's Connecting Point, I actually want to do one more article, and it actually is a headline out of Australia. But because it literally made headline news around the world in virtually every media outlet, I feel like we need to talk about it, and in part because the only reason this made the headline is because of a particular, a cultural agenda. And so as soon as I read the headline, you're going to know what that agenda is, and you're going to roll your eyes, and I know that. But and some of you who complain that I do these kinds of articles too often, I'm sure are going to text me at 877-933-2484, where I do always love to hear from you, love to hear from you on email as well. Carmen@myfaithradio.com. But when we talk about those who are pressing a particular cultural agenda, we as Christians have to be prepared to engage. So here is the headline. I pulled it in this particular version from the USA Today, but you literally could have pulled it from any major media outlet anywhere in the world. Well, in the Western world, because frankly, that's the only part of the world obsessed with sex. Here you go. Same-sex penguins welcome chick, are absolute naturals at parenting, Aquarium says. That's the headline in the USA Today about these two male penguins. Now, let's be very clear. Two male penguins did not produce a chick. Two male penguins did not choose to be isolated from other penguins in an environment where they don't have access to female penguins. Two male penguins are segregated in captivity and therefore relate to one another. Well, they don't relate to one another in ways that you and I would consider aligned with the language of gay. And so when they talk about some other headlines, you see this referred to as gay penguin dads. Now, that suggests the two have some kind of sexual relationship. That's not all what is going on here. We have two male penguins in captivity. They were given a penguin egg. A penguin egg produced in the quite natural way that penguins produce eggs. And these two male penguins, as male penguins are instinctive to do, they took care of the egg in the same way that they do in the wild. These two took care of the egg until, yes, it hatched. However, in some of these articles, you will see the word baby, you will see the word born, you will see the words parents, and in every one of those cases, you and I as Christians need to resist the way the language is being used here. These two male penguins did not produce offspring. These two male penguins are not parents. These two male penguins don't now have a baby. Nor was this chick born. This chick was hatched. And when we talk about something being absolutely natural, the only thing that's absolutely natural about this particular story is that when given an egg, male penguins will actually incubate it. They will care for it. It describes in the article that the new parents are effectively co-parenting and feeding their chick. Again, this is not their chick. This is not their offspring. They are not parents. They are not co-parenting. And so I just think that when we have these kinds of articles, first of all, is a penguin chick a cute little thing? Yes, it is. But it's not a human baby. And those who are raising it as if it is their own are not suddenly parents. And so I think that we just need to be almost insistent in the culture today in terms of the use of language and the words that are co-opted in order to press forward a particular agenda in the human culture. And so, again, let's be mindful that these two male penguins are kept in captivity in a zoo, that an egg was offered to them. They did nurture, incubate the egg, much as they would do in the wild. But what was produced is a chick, not a baby. And what happened was the chick was hatched, not born. And they didn't suddenly become same-sex parents. One more thing. In the Twitter feed of the Sea and Life Sydney Aquarium, who is making a big fuss out of all of this, in their Twitter feed, they say this about this this penguin, first of all, identified here in their Twitter feed as a baby, born Friday, the 19th of October, 2018, at 5:46 p.m., weighing 91 grams, and they say they're that's less than an apple. And then they put gender, to be determined in 2 months' time. Now, when we have the conversation in the culture about gender, is it at all surprising to you that the penguins are identified as male? How are they identified as male? how are they both identified as male? Maybe one of them doesn't identify as male. And this penguin, this new chick, is going to be identified within a couple of months. How exactly? Well, it's going to be based on biology and genetics. I can almost guarantee it. It might even be based on some visible anatomical characteristic. I think we have to keep that in mind in the chaos of the conversations we have today in our culture regarding gender. All right, that's literally all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. You can join me online, myfaithradio.com. Connecting Faith has a page. I've got a new post there for you today. You can also follow me on social media. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. Have a great weekend, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.